Hello, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Today, I've got John Adams with me, and we're going to discuss the Australian economy and what it may look like down the track. John, good morning.
Good morning. How are you going?
Very good. Welcome to DFA. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think a good place to start would be just a little bit of background. You're really focusing on economics. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So in terms of my background, I am an economist, sort of born and bred here in the Illawarra. I did my undergraduate degree at the University of New South Wales, did my honours at the University of Wollongong, and since then I've had a very interesting career within government. I've worked as a public servant, worked as a management consultant for a big four accounting firm. I had the opportunity to be an economic advisor to Senator Arthur Sinodinos back in 2012-13 when the coalition was in opposition. And I've obviously in recent times I've been doing a lot of media commentary, economics, politics, culture, religion, and a few other things. Over the last probably 2 years, I've been focusing very much on what I call structural imbalances in the Australian economy. When we look at house prices, when we look at household debt, foreign debt, and a few things like that.
Okay, great, thanks. So let's just sort of start where we are, right? Because the government is saying there's 1 million jobs being created, the GDP's got a 3 in front of it, so everything in the garden is lovely. But what are we missing?
Well, what are we missing? So, it's interesting you ask that question. So I was actually in Parliament yesterday talking to various government MPs, and I've been saying that the economy is sick. When I say we have these structural imbalances, we have levels of debt relative to income that we haven't seen before.
And this is household debt we're talking about, right?
Well, household debt, but also foreign debt as a proportion of GDP. Okay. So we are at record highs. And you look at economic history in this country, we've had two depressions, 1890 and 1929, and the debt levels today are higher than the two preceding periods of the 1880s and the 1920s. So what I like to say to politicians is, we've got the biggest debt bubble in Australian history. At the same time, we've got the biggest debt bubble in the history of the world.
So why is debt such a problem?
Well, it's because debt ultimately has to be serviced. And obviously, we have one of the reasons why the debt has grown to such epic proportions is because interest rates are so low. And these interest rates can't go on forever, because ultimately, if they do, then people lose confidence in the monetary system. And then basically we'll have some sort of international monetary crisis, which historically doesn't result in a good situation. So if policymakers want to avoid something like that, they do have to raise interest rates, particularly because we're seeing an outbreak of inflation, mainly in the developing world, but also if you look at the developed world, last month you had the New York Federal Reserve saying that underlying inflation in the US was 3.2%, which is the highest since 2006. You look at Germany, Spain, and some of the other European countries, we're getting an outbreak of inflation above the 2% target that the ECB has set. And while we haven't had inflation breakout in Australia yet, there is evidence to suggest that global money supply relative to the global GDP is at a historic high, what that means is that there's sufficient liquidity to ignite a massive outbreak of inflation.
So what that means is, potentially, as I understand what you're saying, is we stand the risk of importing inflation into Australia because of higher rates in other parts of the world.
Yes.
Right. So we've got very, very low interest rates here at the moment, and they've been low for a really long time.
That's correct.
Some would say they're way too low, and we might look at that in a second, right? But even a small increase in rates from this point, particularly if it translated into higher mortgage rates, would have a significant impact on the economy, because it's just such a large proportion of the total economy. And I'm thinking that the need to make those repayments in a rising interest rate environment is going to be one of the catalysts that we need to think about.
Of course. So when I hear you say that, one of the things I'm picking up in your language is about the impact on economic growth. And I guess some of the commentary that I've been trying to, warn in these columns around economic Armageddon is the course of Australian history has been that we tend to be complacent, should be right. We tend to sail towards the iceberg until the iceberg hits. And what is the iceberg? The iceberg is when we get an international shock of one form or another, where, you know, whether it is an international bank saying that they're insolvent or a stock market crashing, etc. And then when the global economy goes into a tailspin, we get swept right through it. So it is correct that if we do raise interest rates, there will be a lot of households struggling if those interest rate increases are moderate, and that will have an impact on economic growth and could tip the economy into a mild recession. But I guess I'm more concerned about the more extreme case, because you look at the imbalances not only in this country, but look at China in the financial sector, look at US corporate debt, look at European governments, and all of these structural imbalances right across the world. It is kind of like a dynamite that could ready to be blown out at any second.
So do you think the trade wars and the growing trade wars could be one of those potential triggers?
So some economists believe that the trade wars will have an impact on global growth, and that could cause an issue around the serviceability of debt if the income generation is slowing up. So obviously global debt is growing at a certain pace. If global income is growing slower, that could have a impact down the track. But I think that the more immediate issue is what's happening with central banks. I mean, we're seeing a very aggressive posture by the US Federal Reserve by raising rates. ECB said they're going to end QE at the end of the year, which, one of the reasons why the Italians haven't defaulted at the moment is because the ECB are largely buying Italian bonds. So, and you look at how interconnected the European banking system is, you know, with rising rates, and with the end of QE, you know, as the ECB has announced, I mean, what I like to say to policymakers is if you've got a balloon full of air and you put a pin through it, which is interest rates, at some point it's going to pop. And when you've got a globally financially integrated system, all it's going to take is for one big institutional government to say, I'm solvent or I can't make certain repayments. And then that's going to collapse confidence right throughout the global economy, and financial markets will move very quickly. And, I've been showing a graph to policymakers about what happened with Italian two-year bonds last month in Italy. So basically, here is what's happened with the two-year Italian bonds in 2.5 weeks. It went from negative 0.138 to 2.738, and obviously that happened in 2.5 weeks. So these markets, which is about a 2,000% increase, so these markets can move very, very rapidly. And I guess one of the concerns in the Australian context is, I mean, you've got the Deputy Reserve Bank Governor giving a speech in February about household debt. And when you look at the data in the speech, they're saying about 27% of mortgage holders have paid less than 1 month in advance. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to know from the RBA earlier this year was of the entire market, who's got variable, who's got fixed. And I emailed them, they came back and they said, as of November last year, 80% of the market is variable. So if you can assume that of this 1 in 4 cohort, a lot of them are variable. At a time we've got net foreign debt at $1 trillion, if global interest rates were to go up rapidly because of instability or someone defaulting, then those costs can quickly go through the banking system onto households who may not have a buffer to meet those rising costs. And that is, for that cohort in particular, that is the sort of Armageddon concern that I'm trying to articulate in these sort of columns with News Limited.
So it's interesting because we model mortgage stress, right? And that's looking at cash flows within households.
Yep.
And we've got around 30% of households now from our modelling that are actually really, really close to the wind with rates really, really low.
Exactly.
So it doesn't take much to be able to start creating significant pain in households and high levels of defaults. And if rates were to rise by, let's say, 2 or 3%, which would be just back to their, you know, middle of the road range,
that's right,
because they're ultra low at the moment, then that could put, you know, 1/3 of households under significant strain. And that's enough to really have a very significant impact.
Of course. And so I think for some policymakers, you know, they're looking at, well, what is the impact on financial stability and the banks? Because historically, when a bank defaults, I mean, that is the catalyst for a deep recession or a depression. And obviously we're getting assurances from the RBA and APRA that everything, you know, that the banks can handle Severe economic conditions. So you got the US Federal Reserve, I think, in the last few days, come out saying that the US banks have passed in terms of their stress test. Whether the banks will survive or not is still, to be determined depending on how things play out. But I guess, part of the reason why I've been writing these columns is to ensure that the average mum and dad, the people who you're picking up in your household surveys, who go to work, listen to the news, listen to the government, they think is everything okay. I want to sort of give them an alternative opinion to say, well, things are not necessarily okay, and that they should be taking prudent action to ensuring that if there are sort of adverse circumstances, that they're ready for them and that they can be prepared for whatever may come.
So if the debt bomb is really the trigger for what you're talking about,
yeah,
what should households be doing now then? Because they've got these large mortgages, right? Incomes have been flat. Costs of living are rising. What should they be doing?
We came out with a column with news.com.au last Thursday, 10 steps of how to prepare for Armageddon. What I wanted to convey in this piece was some financial tips, but also some non-financial tips in terms of how people should be preparing. But I think financially, people should be trying to increase savings, improve their cash flow, whether it's by increasing their income if they're able to, or diversifying their income sources. Because obviously, one of the big issues will be if people lose their job or the main source of income, how can they service their debts? So I think people should be looking at their mortgage products to seeing if they can improve their cash flow by restructuring their finances. So there's a number of different ways that banks can help the ordinary customer with that. By putting some money away, trying to pay down debt wherever possible. They're probably the main financial things that people should be looking at. And obviously trying to cut back on consumption. Because when you look at consumption growth, the whole government strategy around generating a robust economic growth is by people increasing consumption at a rate more than income growth. And this is why we're seeing the household savings ratio fall to 2.1% in the latest National Council, which is the lowest since December 2007. The underlying household factors don't seem like people are being frugal. They don't seem to be saving. And this is completely the wrong set of dynamics you want to be seeing going into a rising interest rate environment when you've got massive debts.
So, John, one of the interesting observations that I get from my surveys is that people say they feel as though the cost of living is much, much higher than the officially reported inflation rate. So what's going on there?
That is a fantastic question. And that's a phenomenon that I was actually seeing working in Parliament in 2012-13. The government official line with CPI is low. We've got low inflation. Whereas when the Liberal Party, for example, was doing its internal polling, the number one economic issue was cost of living. And if you go talk to the politicians today, that is still the number one issue that's coming through their polling. And so it's a very interesting dichotomy. And this is something that have confounded some of the politicians, and a lot of it has to do with what is inflation. Today, the economists and the government says that the definition of inflation is the increase of prices, whereas 100 years ago the definition was the increase in the money supply. So when you inflate money, basically the consequence of that is that prices go up. But it is, you start with increasing the money supply, then you get an increase in prices. And one of the interesting graphs that I've been showing members of Parliament is what's happened to the growth of money relative to the growth of the CPI since the last recession, which was March of 1991. And you basically see that in this graph here, you get a massive increase in the growth of money, about 7.5% year on year. Whereas the growth of the CPI is 2.44% year on year.
So hang on, let's just get that clear. So what you're saying is the real inflation rate in Australia over the last few years is closer to 7% rather than 2% or 3%.
So if you consider, so the Reserve Bank has various measures of money, and the one that I've been using is the broadest definition of money, which is broad money, and that since March of 91 has been growing at 7.5% year on year relative to the CPI, which is 2.44% a year. Now, with the CPI, it doesn't include all prices in the economy. There's been methodological changes that have led to an underestimation of the CPI, which not only in this country, but also in the United States and New Zealand and elsewhere. So so the question is that if we've printed all this money and only a fraction of that money increase in money has only been represented in the CPI, the question is, well, where has it gone?
Yes, well, that was going to be my next question. I'm guessing something to do with household debt?
Yes. So one of the things that shocked me when I was modeling some data a couple of years ago as I was doing my economic research was this graph here. And I'm not sure if other economists around the country have picked this up, but this is one of the, because I haven't seen this before until I came up with it. So credit to housing is a statistical series published by the Reserve Bank. And then I've just sort of said, well, how's that behaved as the economy has grown? And at the last recession, we were at about 22% of GDP, and credit to housing as now is above 96%. Whereas when you look at credit to business, credit to business in proportion of GDP, it's basically remained flat for about 27 years. And then credit to other person, which is non-mortgage debt, has effectively remained flat for about 27 years as well. So it's clear that we've printed all this money and it's gone into one part of this economy.
So that's actually really interesting. So what you're saying is we've had an unofficial QE strategy here, right? So it's basically inflated the money supply by using the housing sector, by allowing banks to lend more for mortgages that's gone into the housing sector. And we've got this big balloon then sitting, which is what we discussed earlier on, about the debt bubble. This is the cause of it.
Well, yes. So, there's a couple of issues here. So I think so it is true that from an Austrian, if you think of Ludwig von Mises, when you print money, the money has to go somewhere. So the distribution mechanism of the credit is back to the banking system, and so we have seen that the banks have channeled this money into housing since the last recession. But that doesn't necessarily, it didn't always have to be the case. So I think there has been an aversion to lending to commercial activity and to business. And I think if you talk to small business, they'll tell you that they've had they've had issues over the years to get access to credit. So there are some politicians who are saying, well, we could or we should have try to direct some of this capital into parts of the business sector to actually get real production going, but because of perhaps the regulatory structure, because of what banks consider to be safe collateral versus more in terms of what their risk profiles are, they have been lending a lot of this money into the banking sector, and one of the things that if you look at the foreign debt statistics is that. The banks in particular were funding a lot of Australia's foreign debt, whereas now, since the GFC, a lot of their commercial lending has been sort of offloaded, and a lot of non-corporate companies who want money from the international credit market are not going through the banking system, but they're going directly to credit markets themselves. So we're seeing some interesting things play in the banking sector, but it largely is that the banks have shoved this money into the household sector, and there's probably a range of factors as to why that has actually taken place.
So the implication there is that banks have been much more willing and able to lend to for housing. By the way, that's a lower risk rating on the Bank for International Settlements Basel III structure.
Mm-hmm.
So in fact, the regulatory structure globally is actually encouraging more lending to housing.
Yep.
Relative to the commercial end of things. But yet, as you say, lending to the housing sector and for mortgages is not productive, right? It's just inflating. Whereas lending for commercial purposes can create real growth.
Precisely. And the point you're just making there is, when I say in my columns and when I tell politicians that we have structural imbalances, it is the high house prices relative to disposable income, the high household debt relative to disposable income, and this statistic here is Australian high. So this is more than your 1880s, your 1920s, when we and the two periods leading into the two depressions we've had. You look at the net foreign debt. I mean, this takes us back to June of last year, but in the first 9 months of this financial year, the foreign debt continues to go back up, and we're above $1 trillion in net foreign debt. And when you look at household savings, I think we talked about earlier in the interview, the national account says that it's at 2.1%, so the lowest since December of 2007. So we're basically seeing, all of this credit channeling into one sector. We're getting historic highs of a range of metrics, which historically says that once interest rates normalize, and if you think of what the cash rate was between the last recession and say 2008, before we had the ultra low interest rate, it was at 6.29%, and we're at 1.5% now. And even if you include from the March of 91, say to last year, the average was about 5.3. So if we were to normalize it back to the long-term average, we are talking substantially higher interest rates. And I think your service is saying that a lot of households are struggling at the moment. So if rates were to go up another 4%, we would see huge number of defaults.
So I find this quite interesting, right? Because on one hand, what the Reserve Bank wants is growth. And that means greater household consumption.
Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that means that more debt is better, right? If long as it doesn't go wrong. And more spending is better, which means that less saving is good. Right? That seems to me the sort of the fundamental logic that the Reserve Bank is sitting on. But those seem to me to be counter to what's good for households, insofar that if debt gets too high, then it's hard to manage, right? If you don't have savings, then you've got nothing by way of a buffer if things go wrong. And actually, the first thing that happens when people get into difficulty is they draw the horns in and spend less. So it's like we're living in an Alice in Wonderland version of reality.
Yeah, thing is, so I wouldn't say that's just a strategy of the RBA. It's a strategy of the Turnbull-Morrison government. It was interesting. I had before the May budget that came out, I had a meeting with a member of parliament earlier this year, and I basically said to the MP, I said, do you realise that increasing consumption growth and driving down household savings is an implicit strategy of your government to boost economic growth? And the MP goes, where did you get this from? I said, it's in your own budget papers from last year. So, and the MP was quite shocked by what I was saying, but so it's clearly outlined in the budget papers. The politicians and the markets are looking at a very, very short-term horizon in terms of growth, and all of the things you say is what they're trying to pursue, but this is completely unsustainable. When Keynes said that we're all dead in the in the long run, we're dead, so it doesn't really matter. Well, I think we're coming close to that long-run position, and people like you and me, we're not dead, and we have to face the music.
So we've got this big debt issue then, right? And credit has been growing significantly faster than income for a long time. And in fact, credit growth has been driving GDP because that's the way the numbers work, right? But how do we get ourselves out of this massive debt burden that we've got, both at a household level and at a country level? It seems hard to navigate a way forward from this point.
Yes. So one of the things I've been telling some MPs is if you think you can click your fingers and the debt's just going to vanish, well, you're living in a fantasy land. The debt is here. The couple of economists, Peter Breen and Ian Manning, they wrote a book called Credit Code Red, where they're predicting a local currency crisis for Australia that will default on our foreign debt. I had some time with them last week, and one of the things they said to me is, second is quarter of a century plus to come to this position, You know, it would take a very long time for us to unwind this position. And there are things we can do from a public policy point of view to unwind it by, you know, raising interest rates, doing tax reform. Because one of the things I say to MPs is, if you've got $50,000 and you go put it in a bank to get a term deposit, well, you're paying full marginal tax on the savings or on the interest. Whereas if you take that $50,000 and then go borrow and buy an investment property, well, you get deductions in the tax code. So the tax system is designed to punish savers and actually to encourage debt. So there are things you can do in the tax code. There are things that we can do with welfare, because I mean, there's clear evidence in the economic literature that says that the more welfare you provide to a society, the less incentive it gives for people to save. I mean, if you don't have to save for unemployment, for education, for healthcare, for retirement, then obviously it gives people a less incentive to save. So there are some things we can do gradually, but I guess the issue is, do we have time to unwind it? And one of the things I tell politicians is, well, we haven't even begun the process, because while some MPs say prices in my electorate, like in Sydney or Melbourne, are coming down, the debt can, and this is obviously something that, you know, you have, you know, repeatedly said in your post, the debt continues to grow, whether it's a mortgage debt or non-mortgage debt. And so we haven't even begun the process to unwind. And the question is, do we have, and if we were to do that, to start that process, do we have time to unwind this to a more sustainable level, such that overseas is not going to blow up? And I think we don't have that time, because you know it's taken us 25 years to come to this position. It would take at least probably 5 to 10 years, to do this gradually without any major economic hardship or disruptions. And I don't think the world's going to survive that length of time before these things come to a head, particularly because the Americans are being super aggressive with raising interest rates.
So we've got the debt bomb, the fuse is fizzing away.
Yeah,
right? I can sort of imagine it, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, you can do some things like tweaking interest rates, perhaps, or you can do some tax stuff or whatever. But do we then have to look at more radical alternatives? And I'm thinking of things like, well, there's a thing called the Chicago Plan, which basically says we can't get out of this using normal economic strategies, right? So you either got to find a way of forgiving debt or restructuring debt in such a radical way that it becomes less critical in the economy. I mean, do we have to go there to sort of work this through, or do we, I mean, I'm trying to think of what the alternatives are if we can't just sit there and hope it will muddle through.
Well, yes. So I don't think conventional policy options and conventional thinking is actually going to get us out of this out of this situation. I mean, obviously there are radical plans being conveyed in the international arena. From what I can tell, I don't think those sort of plans are being discussed widely within the federal parliament. So, and to be honest, even yesterday, I'm briefing senators, MPs, and I don't think not all policymakers are acutely aware of the scale of the challenge. So part of, I think, with your post and with other commentary and what I'm trying to do with some of my columns is to bring attention to the problems. I think the official line by the regulators and the Reserve Bank is that we are still at sustainable levels. And I don't think that looking at the historical evidence, I don't think that that's a reasonable justification. So it will have to be radical. I mean, whether the system just crashes and we have some sort of big default, I mean that potential could happen. If we do have a shock, like a bank declaring that they are insolvent, one thing I will think is that they will attempt to print their way out of it. So I think some people say that the scale of the shock will be so significant that, imagine if you're standing on the beach, the power of the wave is going to be so much that we can't do anything to stop the wave from coming into shore. So that's why some people think we're going to have some sort of sovereign debt crisis or a depression. Whereas some people believe that, no, there will be an attempt to print. Now, after the GFC, they printed $15 trillion. Some people think that they will attempt to print. Some people think they will be ineffective in that effort. Some people think they will be successful to the extent that we have runaway inflation. Some people talk about having a debt jubilee, but I don't think that those are plausible options, because I don't think the counterparty would accept not being paid. Whether it is in the banking system or whether it is between governments. Because you know, when you say you're going to forgive debt, well, someone has lent the money and they have to take the loss. And particularly when you look at banks, I mean, can these counterparties, you know, depending on how much debt you want to forgive, I mean, can the counterparties absorb those sort of losses necessary to make this global economy sustainable? I don't think some of these plans have, you know, more of these radical plans have actually thought through, well, what's the counterparty side and what are they willing to accept, and what does this mean for the shareholders, the customers, and financial stability.
So it sounds as though there are a lot of big issues in play, but in Australia we're not really even off first base yet in terms of really recognizing the situation that we're in, at least at a sort of a political level and an economic level. Would that be right in your view?
So there's clearly a group of MPs and senators who are acutely aware of these issues, who are concerned, who may not accept what their leaders are saying. There are people who don't think it is an issue. So there are people who think it's a big issue. Some people, you know, who I've spoken to think that. That these are interesting trends, that what you're talking about in your post and what I'm talking about, but it hasn't reached to the point of being too concerned that we need to have a fundamental, radical, different approach to policy. And there are some people who are not across the issues, and obviously I was speaking to some of them yesterday and bring them up to speed, and obviously they had a range of questions and I was trying to sort of answer those questions as robustly as I could, just so that they could have a full sort of picture of what I see and what people like you see. So I think the consciousness is rising. You look at Chris Bowen, he gave a speech at the National Press Club, he talked about rising global risks. In Question Time yesterday, both Shorten and Bowen asked questions of the government about a global economic risk. So I think the commentary is starting to seep into the consciousness of the politicians. I think when we look at Reserve Bank and APRA, I think their position is that while debt levels are high, they are still sustainable. And I think the Reserve Bank is looking at particularly the distribution of the debt, which is, you know, and leading into the GFC with subprime, a lot of poor people held a big bulk of the debt, and they didn't have the ability to service that debt. Whereas a lot of a big chunk of the Australian household debt, and obviously you can speak to this with more authority than I can, is being held by middle to higher income people. And I think that gives, you know, while we still have full employment and we have you know, a reasonably healthy job market, I think that's giving the Reserve Bank confidence that we are still in sustainable levels. But obviously, you know, it doesn't take much for the job market to turn, you know, like very quickly on its head. And I think that's what they haven't accounted for. And obviously, you know, there are other sort of respected people. You know, John Hewson's been very critical of the Reserve Bank in Fairfax Press. And then you had Peter Costello, former treasurer in The Australian last year, calling on Philip Lowe to raise interest rates now so that they can raise them earlier, so that you can start to get this debt issue under control, rather than having to raise them more dramatically later on if there's an issue with the currency in the foreign exchange markets.
So as we sort of come to the end of our discussion, what do you think the most critical point is that you'd want to make and you'd want to sort of communicate as widely as you can as to where we are?
The critical point is like for the ordinary Aussie, don't trust the system. I think ultimately every Australian needs to assume responsibility for themselves and their own households. And while the official line is being presented to them, listen to it. They should do their own homework. They should try to see how robust is that position, noting that, you know, the establishment did not predict the GFC, whether it was, you know, it was whether the government or the Reserve Bank or APRA, etc. No one saw it last time. They're saying that they can't see anything coming this time. You know, I disagree with that public assessment that they're putting forward. And so, so I think ultimately that individuals need to ensure that they're prepared for all forms of economic conditions.
John Adams, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
Good talking to you.
Thank you.
So there you are. You heard it from John there. Do your own homework. Don't just trust the official line. And watch out. We could be in for a bumpy ride ahead. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Thanks for watching. I'll talk to you again next time.